So this morning's talk will be on the sound of silence. No, it won't. Otherwise, you don't get any talk at all. Now, I promise I'll give a talk this morning on mindfulness. And it's one of those words which is so overused like anything else. That it gets confusing, it gets degraded, it gets misunderstood simply because it's become a buzzword. And sometimes, and it's part of the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, it's part of meditation, but when you take a little part of it out, you don't have all the other supporting factors there, and you don't have a context, it can get very confusing and sometimes misses the point. Because I've known many people, and this is true, they say, oh, you know, as long as you're mindful, you're on the path to enlightenment. You know, you can have sex as long as you're mindful. You can, you know, as long as you sort of, you know, have a few beers, as long as you're mindful when you're drinking. Or when you are robbing a house. Burglars are very mindful when they're robbing a house. So the burglars must be on the path to enlightenment because they're incredibly mindful. And there's obviously something very, very wrong with that idea. So today I'm going to talk about what mindfulness really is and just, you know, how it's to be understood as an important support for your meditation, for your health and happiness and success in life, and also for the insights on the path to enlightenment. But first of all, mindfulness is just, you know, being aware. But what does that really mean? Are you truly aware? And it also begs the question, aware of what? Because in real mindfulness, when you put it as a true practice, it's not just being aware just in some dull awareness. It really is heightened, strong awareness, and putting your awareness in places which are going to be helpful and useful. Everybody is aware. Even people who have road traffic accidents, yeah, they're aware when they're driving, only they're aware of the mobile phone they're holding in their hand instead of the traffic in front of them. But say, yeah, I was aware when I sort of crashed into the truck in front of me. But you're aware of the wrong thing. So with awareness, first of all, mindfulness, it is, you know, being aware, but also being aware of the correct thing. Now, first of all, you know, being even aware of the correct thing. If you ever go to any of the psychotherapists, there's supposed to be one here, so you'll actually increase the understanding of what you're doing by coming to places like this and strengthen your understanding of the mind. First of all, now the awareness will have to be taken away from the thinking. And that's one of the first jobs, you know, if you go into any sort of therapy or psychologist, you know, take you away from your head. Because we live in a world of our thinking, our whole worldview is constructed of ideas and thoughts, and it's not real. And this is a credible thing about sort of most people, they are not living in the real world. And when people come and see me, you're a monk, you're afraid of relationships, you're too lazy to get a job, and they come and say, get real, Ajahn Brahm. I say, what do you mean? You're the people who aren't real, you know, watching fantasy movies like The Hobbit, or watching vampires and zombie movies. And who's the real person here, and who's really got a life, and who's living in this world of fantasies and dreams? And some people told me years ago on the internet you have this thing called Second Life, and apparently there's even an internet currency now called Bitcoin. I mean, who's real? Sometimes people live in a world of fantasies and dreams. No, real of the fantasies on computers and movies on TVs, or they live in reality. Which one do you live in? So one of the first things with awareness and mindfulness is to get real. Which is one of the reasons why people start any mindfulness training with physical sensations or things like taste or anything which gets you out of your head and thinking into the real world of life. And I tell a lot of people, if you're on a retreat and you're getting very dull or sort of frustrated, it's mostly because you're in your head, you're thinking things. And instead of doing that, go outside And just even if you're on the concrete or on the bitumen, take your shoes off and feel the ground on the soles of your feet. Take off your blankets, for goodness sake, or your hats, and feel the flies. Now feel the sun on your head. Feel the wind. Go out when it's raining and get wet. Now start to feel the world instead of always protecting yourself against the world. Because that's what we do with blankets and hats. We are so insulated from the real world that we're not really alive anymore. So you go out there and do things like that. It's a bit uncomfortable. Yeah, you get cold, you get wet, you may step on something, but at least you're becoming aware of your bodily feelings. And it's incredible that when a person starts to become aware of just their physical feelings, it's a whole world opens up to you. And it's a world which, once you're aware of these things, you can actually start to manipulate those feelings in the sense of getting some good health and relaxation from pain, because you're aware of feelings, you know how they work. So instead of being a victim of, you know, health problems or physical problems, because you're aware, you can actually find out how they work. You're actually observing them instead of thinking about them. And I've been doing that for such a long time, I'm very aware of my body, and so actually my body's pretty healthy. You know exactly how it feels, exactly what it wants. And I love telling that story of a couple of years ago. I think I told that the first night, you know, when I had the food poisoning. And just because you're aware of the body, and have been trained to be aware of the body, it's so easy to relax that pain all away. And you can do that in so many other times. Sometimes you're in bed at night, you've got an ache somewhere. You know, that's right, when I was in Thailand last time, you know, I didn't trip, but I was walking to the meditation hall early one morning. I didn't see a step, and so I just jolted my knee, and it was aching for a while. And all I needed to do is, whenever it started to ache, is to put my awareness there. Not to think about it, but to feel it. Because if you started thinking about it, you think, oh my goodness, this is really bad. Perhaps I have to go and have a knee reconstruction, which means I have to go to hospital. And before I go to hospital, before they put me into knee reconstruction, they'll probably tell me to lose weight. And I don't want to lose weight. I'm quite happy with who I am because I'm following the Fat Buddha. That is my sort of hero in life. And they'll tell me to do all these other things. And once they start to give you one test, they'll give you another test. And you have to go into hospital so many times a week. And it's just such a pain in the backside. But you can think like that, but that's a stupid thing. So instead of thinking and worrying and planning and complaining, you're aware of it, simple as that, without thoughts. And once you have awareness, you notice that feelings change. No matter how much it hurts or how little it hurts, it's never the same one moment after another. The feelings in the body are always oscillating. And sometimes, if you're aware, you can also notice what makes the feeling worse and what makes it less intense. Because you are aware, you are now learning and getting some wisdom. And it doesn't take that much of wisdom to realize that when you tense up through fear or control or through wanting it to be different, that scrunches it up and makes the pain worse. When you let it go, when you say, welcome monster into my knee or into my body, thank you for visiting, you open the door of your heart up to that pain. You don't fight it anymore. You welcome, embrace, accept, and even are kind to it, then it gets less. Brilliant insight. Now you have an incredibly powerful method to heal your own body. Awareness and kindness. And sometimes I used to tell people, it's not just awareness you're learning, but you're learning all these other incredibly powerful emotions inside of you. Kindness. Do you know what kindness is? What compassion is? You know that we chant every morning and evening here, you know, the Metta Sutta, whatever living beings they may be, except for nuns. May they That's just a joke. You know, may all beings be happy and well. Is that really compassionate? You can chant that, but when you go outside and you find somebody has sat in your chair, or you find that somebody's taken the last piece of toast, or whatever it is, now, where's your compassion gone now? So we can say it, we can chant it, we don't feel it. And this is where you understand what compassion really is. It's not a word, it's not a chant anymore. It's that thing, that movement of the mind, which relaxes everything, which can take a pain in your guts, indigestion, and can totally relax it. That was compassion. Letting things be. Opening the door of your heart. So when you learn what awareness is so many other things become open for you, and you're not thinking anymore, you're feeling, you're becoming wise to how this whole thing works. You're becoming aware especially of your, not just your physical, you start with your physical world, how to sort of relax things. Can you sit for long periods sitting down? You can if you're sitting down on an armchair watching a 3-hour movie. You don't have to get up because it's really interesting. And in fact, people can watch these movies or they can watch sports matches and they can have all sorts of aches and pains in them and it doesn't matter at all. They're sitting still because the game's not over yet. Why is that? And it's obvious because a lot of times when we're restless, when we're not enjoying things, we actually look in our body for the aches and pains, just some excuse to distract ourselves. A lot of the reasons why people get out of meditation is not because their leg is hurting. Yeah, it's aching, but it's not the big thing. It's actually, you know, you're bored, you're distracted, you just don't want to carry on anymore. But I tell you this, if you are getting into a deep meditation and you're already enjoying yourself, to hell with my legs, to hell with my tummy, I'm enjoying this. Just, you know, like, you know, seeing a great movie, it hasn't finished yet, you're not going to get up until it's finished. Even though you're bursting to go to the toilet. Sorry, I have to wait. Now this is actually where you start learning about the nature of all your reactions to these things and how, if you can really be kind to your body at the very beginning by being mindful of it, being aware of how you are sitting at the very beginning, and being so aware that you can be kind and relax everything. So the awareness is not the thinking, it's the feeling. And it's always associated, if you want to use it properly, with this beautiful kindness. The other part of mindfulness, which we learnt when we learnt the Pali language, the word we have for mindfulness, sati, is the same as the word for memory. And it's not just being aware, it's the awareness which carries the instructions, knowing what you should be doing. It's not just being aware of having sex with somebody else's wife. It carries awareness, I shouldn't be doing this, this is not right. Now that is a full awareness. It's awareness with wisdom, which is why people like Ajahn Chah would never use the word mindfulness by itself. Would always use satipanya or satisampajanya, which means mindfulness with wisdom. In other words, it's not just being aware, it's knowing where you are supposed to be aware and carries the instructions of understanding what you're aware of, its problems, its difficulties, how you should be relate to it. It carries those instructions with it as well. So if you want to practice what they call bare awareness, in other words, just being aware, you'll be just like Teddy Bear because he practices bare awareness. Which okay, come on, I'd laugh, it's a terrible joke. But he's very happy, but obviously he's inanimate and will never get enlightened. But the awareness always has to come with, you know, some instructions with it. And those instructions are basically to be kind, to let go, not to control, not to get indulged in things, but to leave things alone. That's a basic instruction which, you know, awareness always should carry with it. And the other part, it's not just, again, not just being aware, it's being aware of something, pointing it, carrying some wisdom with it. So, now, for example, the simile of driving a car. Now, the awareness comes with the knowledge, I should not be answering my mobile phone when I'm, you know, just driving in the traffic. If it's a very busy traffic, I should not be watching my breath, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, crash. What's the traffic? That's what you should be watching, not something else. So it's the awareness which carries wisdom with it, which means you are safe. Now the other thing with mindfulness, which is very important, which I don't know why, but few teachers actually emphasize this. Mindfulness is not just something you're mindful or you're not mindful. Mindfulness has all these different degrees of power to it, intensity. Because everybody is mindful. In other words, they're aware of something. But a lot of times their awareness is really dull. So number one, it's got no power. And number two, it's usually aware of the wrong thing because they're not carrying the wisdom with them, which is why we get into trouble. So we have awareness and increasing its power and also learning how to focus it in useful places, carrying the information of the Dharma with us. And the learning how to focus, you know, in the right, sorry, giving it some power, you find that there's sometimes in the retreat when you've got very low mindfulness. For example, you first wake up in the morning. What time is it? Oh, 3 o'clock. Oh, God, what am I getting up at? You're not very aware, are you? Maybe you have to have a cup of coffee first, and then you are sort of aware. But you will notice throughout the day you have higher degrees of awareness and lower degrees of awareness. In other words, how much you can feel, how much you can know, how much you can really pick up from the sensory experience you have right now. And this is a great part of meditation because it's not just, I am now going to be aware. It's building up the power of mindfulness. And in one of my first books which I wrote, I just coined the word, you know, power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. To make the point that mindfulness isn't just one thing. You need to increase its power and energy so you can see much more. So, the simile I always teach on every retreat, the road up to Bodhinyana Monastery, which now you have all been up that road at least once, because that's how you got here, unless you came by helicopter, and I never saw anyone doing that. So you all came up that road. Now, I mentioned a few days ago, it was the 30th anniversary of Bodhinyana Monastery. We went there in 1983, and it was about, I estimate, about 7 years I'd been meditating in that monastery. And it wasn't just meditate. We'd go out to buy stuff to get for the buildings, you know, on the treasurer's account, and just go up and down for going to teach in town and doing all this other business which we had to do. So I'd been going up and down that road, I would say on average 3 or 4 times a week for 7 years. So you'd think I would know Kingsbury Drive. But it was after 7 years, it was a beautiful spring morning, no flies. Thank you, Firefly. No flies around, plenty of time, not rushing to get anywhere. And I asked the driver of the car, please let me out at the bottom of the road. I want to walk up today. It's quite a steep road. And it's about 2.2 kilometers to the gate of Bodhinyana Monastery. So he let me out. And you know, these days people won't do that because when they got me in the car, they want to ask me all questions on meditation and everything else. That's my problem these days. Whenever I see someone, I'm really paranoid they're going to ask me another question. Even that sort of point, that story in Hong Kong some years ago, I've been giving a long talk, asking questions afterwards. You know, after the talk, you say any questions, and people put their hands up, and then any more questions? No. And so we finish off, and then there's a big line of people asking their questions. And it's really hard to get out. You know, you can go out and go to the toilet any time, but I'm stuck here until you let me go. And eventually I managed to get out and go into the foyer. And there was more people waiting to ask me questions there. And so I'm always kind, and actually, you've got no choice but to be kind. They're going to ask you the question anyway. And so you ask the questions, and finally, at last, I was bursting. I made it into the toilet. And as soon as I got into a toilet, there was a man there just finished washing his hands. And he said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question on meditation? I thought, oh, give me a break. Even inside the toilet, I can't get any peace and quiet. So anyway, that's why it's very hard to get out of a car because you got me trapped. But I got out of the car and I started walking up the hill. Now, the point of this story is that once I got out of that car and started walking, I could not recognize Kingsby Drive. The hillside looked totally, I mean, really different than anything I've ever seen before. And that really shook me. So I've been living here for 7 years. How come it looks so different? And it was such an amazing experience. I stopped and stared. And that's when the hillside changed again. And it became this incredibly beautiful hillside with so many features I never realized existed. And what's going on? And one of the things as a Buddhist, and that's why I became a Buddhist after being a scientist, when things happen, you just investigate, what's going on? You ask those questions. And I came up to this theory, which is why I tell this story, because it explains a lot of mindfulness. It was just the nature of seeing, the physiology of the eye. When light hits the back of the eye, it forms an image. It takes a fraction of a second before an image is formed, but it takes time before an image is formed on the back of the eye. It's a chemical reaction. And it takes time to fully form. What happens with most people, especially if you're looking through the window of a car which is going at some many kilometers an hour, the light hasn't got enough time to fully form an image on the back of your eye before another image comes up to replace the first, then another image, then another image. That's what it's like when you're watching through the window of a car. The images don't have time to properly form. So you don't see much detail, and the colors are washed out. But when you walk, literally the more time is there to form a fuller, more complete image in the back of your eye, and also you've got more time to explore that image before another one comes and disturbs the first. So I could literally see more things. And instead of smears, like glass was individual blades. And I could see more. But it never did as well as standing still, because when I stood still, the chemical reaction in the back of the eye had full time to complete. So what I saw was the real colors and all the different details and textures which were there all the time in that mountain or that hillside, but I could never see them because I was going too fast. And not only did you see so much detail, but that was one of those times the colors were like fluorescent. They were always like that. Only you don't give them enough time to fully form and show what their real nature is. And that was one of the first similes I got for power mindfulness. When you are going fast in life, it is like being in a car, speeding along, looking out through the window, and you really assume that what you see outside is what is out there. You are missing 99%. You get out and walk, yeah, that's not bad. But you stand still. You don't move. Only then do your senses have the opportunity to fully absorb all that information. The colors are now rich, and everything is, even the sound of the birds, is just so deep, so powerful. Because you're picking everything up. Now that's what happens with mindfulness. It's power mindfulness, and it always comes with a sense of happiness, seeing beauty in ordinary things, being able to hear very deeply, not just what is said, but the whole texture of the sound. It really does thrill you because your ears are wide open now. Tasting, knowing whatever's going on in your head. If it's a thought or an emotion, you can fully know it. Why is it that the emotions of anger, fear, guilt, anxiety still rule inside your emotional world? Why have they got so much power? Because you haven't understood them. Why haven't you understood them? Because you've been going too fast. You have not seen them. No more could I see that hillside when I was driving through it in a car. You have to stop and be still. And then the mindfulness increases. And the strange thing, which I never expected at the time, but now I really understand how it works, everything is filled with delight. The world is a beautiful place. People are incredibly wonderful, beautiful people. That's why I keep smiling at you and never sort of criticize you. Look, I can see so much beauty in you. Even when I go to prisons, you know, how on earth can you go to prison and just spend half an hour with a child rapist and respect him? If you go fast, you can't see anything. If you go slow and be still, it's incredible what you see in the most unexpected places. If a piece of shit in the bottom of the toilet could look beautiful, you can imagine what you see in a jail. Incredible beauty. This is your mindfulness is going to a different level. So it's the stillness, it's really, really important. It's the stillness which gives power to mindfulness. Which is why here, don't talk about mindfulness until we talked about stillness first of all. You can't force mindfulness. I am now going to be mindful. Okay, Ajahn Brahm, now be mindful. That's not mindfulness at all, that's playing. You grow and develop mindfulness by sitting here being still. And you get that. After a while you become so much more aware of so many more things in this retreat center. And happiness does grow little by little. That is the sign. If you see someone who's miserable and they say, be quiet, get out of my way, I'm being mindful. They haven't got a clue what mindfulness is. And sometimes people are like that. Say, I'm keeping noble silence, you shut up, I'm trying to be mindful. That's not mindfulness, that's just control freak stuff. The mindfulness is when you really can taste everything. Your mind is really, really alert and it's full of just whatever's there. And it always comes with delight and beauty as well. And that's why, you know, we have all of these practices to develop mindfulness. But the other part of mindfulness is learning how to focus it on the interesting places. Because you can be mindful of the shit in the toilet bowl, which is weird, but it doesn't really get you anywhere. You know, maybe become an expert on feces, but you know, that's you can't get a degree on that, at least not that I know of yet. So it's, you know, it's fun, but so what? So, I already mentioned with your physical feelings in the body, that's quite helpful because health is an enormous asset for human beings. And so just little things like just, you know, why do you get sort of indigestion? I think I already mentioned the other day, because a lot of times people don't even taste their food. They're busy talking to the person next to them. So they're not even tasting the food. They're interested in the conversation. They're just putting it inside their mouth with no awareness. Or you may be thinking, you're having your lunch today, you have this great fantasy, you know, of what you're going to do next, of winning, or sort of hitting the winning run for Sri Lanka in the cricket against Australia, or whatever else your fantasies are. Or your fantasy of finding this incredible hot guy who's rich and who loves you to bits so you can settle down, you've got the love of your life. Your soulmate, as you're fantasizing there, my soulmate. You don't know what you're putting in your mouth. So all those thinking and fantasies and stuff, that means you're not aware. So I'm now going to introduce the mindfulness of eating lesson. When you're going to have your lunch, maybe you've noticed this already, maybe you can understand that you do this yourself. Suppose you're having your lunch using a spoon. You will notice, yourself and others, you've got some, say, rice and curry in the spoon. Well, you've already got some in your mouth being chewed. And you're looking, oh, perhaps with the other hand, you're sort of messing around with the food in the plate, making this heap, because that's number three, and that's number four, and after that I'm going to have that one over there. So many people are three or four spoons ahead of themselves, which means they're not aware of what they're actually chewing. They're planning what they're going to eat, not even in the next spoon. That's already in the spoon waiting in line. It's what the next one over there is. So look. When you're having your lunch today, see if you can be aware of that and just have one mouthful at a time. Pick it up with your spoon or fork, put it in your mouth and stop. chew it and taste it before you even think of what you're going to put in your mouth next. That's called being in the moment. It's being aware. That means you can actually taste the food. And when you start tasting the food is usually delicious. And the more mindful you are, the more you can get those tastes out. And you notice, I just say now, think of your favorite food right now. Think of it with your eyes closed. Think of your favorite food. I think it's just right in front of you. Hot and steaming, a big bowl of it. You're very, very famous for your favorite restaurant. It's right there in front of you. Don't you get saliva coming out? Even just thinking of the food, you know, actually gets all these enzymes and other things secreted from your body. I learned this because there was one of my fellow monks years and years ago. He was an Australian monk from Melbourne. And he had a bad digestion. And so they sent him to the hospital in Thailand to find out what was wrong with him. And they gave him one of these barium meals. You know, this disgusting liquid you drink. And it's supposed to be radioactive. And this is old days, so you'll sit in your tummy, and then they can, you know, we use x-rays or whatever, they can actually check just how it goes through your system. So they can actually see which way it goes. Now, they made a stupid mistake in Thailand by giving him the appointment in the afternoon, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And he was a monk. You know, we don't eat in the afternoon. He'd been a monk for enough years that his stomach had got used to actually just resting in the afternoon. So they put the barium meal inside his tummy and nothing happened. And with you guys, you know, because you eat a lot, you know, all the time, not 3 meals a day, 4, 5, whenever you feel hungry. So it all sat there, it didn't do anything. So they couldn't do the test. And they realized what had happened, but there was one really smart nurse there. And all they did to this monk said, think of your favorite food. And as soon as he started thinking of his favorite food, the barium meal started working through his system. That's all he needed to do to turn on his digestive system, just to think of the favorite food. But if you're thinking of the conversation you're having with the person sitting next to you, or you're planning what you're going to do next, or you're thinking about, you know, what you're going to do when you go home after the retreat, you're not aware, so that's why nothing gets digested. So little things like that, awareness of eating, being here in this moment, is great for your health. And it also means that you can lay down in bed and be aware enough to relax your body and go to sleep at night. How many of you have difficulties going to sleep at night? It's amazing. This is one of the problems of our modern world. Why is that? I'm worried about what I have to do tomorrow. If you're not worried about what you're going to have to do tomorrow, I'm worried I may not be able to go to sleep. That's the most stupid one. You're trying to go to sleep and you're worried about not going to sleep, which is why you can't go to sleep. You're really crazy people. But anyway, this person over in Sydney, I will, you know, go and teach all over the place, and she told me that, you know, she used one of these very simple meditation techniques, the mindfulness of sweeping through the body, being mindful of your toes, then your feet, then your ankles, then your calves, your knees, your thighs, your bottom, all the way up to the body, being aware of it. You know, deliberately just looking and feeling just what your toes are like right now. And little by little, moving up the body. And she said that this was working so well with her customers who had insomnia, that she started her internet company, she made a fortune, she calls it sleeplikeababy.com, and she just gives a standard mindfulness of the body technique, which the Buddhists have been doing for hundreds of years, and she's making a fortune, because she said, she told me, I remember her saying, 100% success rate, 100% success rate, it always works. And the reason is number one, you're mindful of your body rather than mindful of all your anxieties and fears and guilt and what happened in the past. You're mindful, but it brings you into the present moment. And number two, you're actually relaxing the body. And a lot of times the reason why people can't sleep at night, there's too much tightness, too much pain in your body. You know, because of all the emotional stress of the day. You just need a big massage. And if you can't get someone to massage you, you do this mindfulness sweeping, and it's just exactly the same. Everything relaxes. So you can go to bed and you can just relax yourself, way off into sleep. Not only that, I remember teaching this sweeping technique to the Breast Cancer Society in Perth. They came down to monastery once. You know, and it's a terrible thing having breast cancer. And I was telling this technique, just sweeping through the body, up through your thighs, your bottom, to your waist, until you get to your breasts. Can you notice any feelings there? By this time, you're really mindful. Relax those feelings. And they find they can relax their own breasts. And really, so they feel so beautiful, so healthy, so free. So you've just got rid of a couple of tumors. Because that's what happens. The tightness. You don't just get a breast cancer. It builds up out of a lot of stress or a lot of imbalance, whatever it is. And just paying attention to a place and giving it relaxation, it's incredible the power that does. You relax it all away, just like food poisoning. You can relax away tumors as well. Now, that's interesting stuff, isn't it? This is not just, you know, crazy religion anymore. This is stuff which actually works and can work for you. And it's such a simple thing to do, to get that awareness and focus it in a good place. If you start thinking about it, it doesn't work. You've got to feel it. Get away from the thoughts and get into the reality of what's going on inside your body to feel it. So that's one of the reasons why we meditate, to get people out of their head into the feelings. And not only that, get them to know what this kindness is. Once you've got your body relaxed, maybe you can start becoming aware of your emotional world. And that's one of the most powerful, that's almost like the prime cause of what happens in your body. Now that's can create a huge amount of happiness and health, or can really kill you, just the emotional world. They call it stress, all these stress-related illnesses, but stress is such a wide word. There's a lot of illnesses are called fear-created illnesses. Amazing just how scared people are in this world. And I remember as a student, I was reading these short stories by this weird British novelist called Edgar Allan Poe. You know, he was a cult figure because, you know, all these, you know, weird, dark, sinister stuff which he was writing. And one of his short stories was The Mask of the Red Death. They made a movie out of it later on. And they didn't actually mention this in the movie, because the movie was just more Hollywood, you know, just more devils and beautiful virgins getting caught by the devils and giving this terrible disease of people fighting. You know what it's like in movies. It has to be sex and violence. No sex and violence, it's a waste of time having a movie. That's why they'll never make a movie about monks. No violence, no sex, boring. So they had this movie, Mask of the Red Death. And in the book, you know, they had this wonderful scene, passage in the book, where they said it was, now this was a long time ago, so they thought it was some sort of religious demons or devils or something creating these plagues. And they had all these devils meeting in a forest somewhere in France, just, you know, talking to each other. And one said, yeah, I've just been to London, I killed 10,000 people. And one said, I was in Berlin, I killed 12,000. I've just been in Paris and I killed 13,000. And I just been, you know, to Italy, to Rome. I only killed 5,000, but fear killed 50,000. And I always remember that when he said, just fear killed more people than the plague killed. And I thought, what a great insight that is. Fear kills more people than cancer does. Do you get it? You're so afraid, you create those things. Once you realize the emotional world and how strong it is and how that can create health or sickness, then you know this mindfulness on this emotional world gives you a huge power. You can actually see fear coming You know fear. You can taste it, touch it, because you're so aware inside. It's as real to you as holding up a dangerous lion. You can touch it because you've been aware for such a long time of it. You know it well. Remember, when you don't know these things, how on earth can you understand and deal with it and actually transcend it? That's one of the, I was quoting the Chinese Art of War this last night. Know your enemy, know yourself, 1,000 battles won. 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. I'll say that again. Know your enemy, know yourself, 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. Know yourself, but know your enemy. Know fear. Understand what it is. And then it's so easy to overcome it. So you're mindful of it. You see it coming. You see just how it exaggerates things. And it can catch anybody. It's embarrassing, but I don't mind laughing at myself and saying what a stupid monk I was. I was meditating in the jungle in Thailand, okay? Just out there in the jungle, mosquito net up, because also many mosquitoes. And there are very dangerous animals in the jungle. They always said bears are the most dangerous because they're crazy. They just go for you, even though it's, you know, a stupid thing to do. There are tigers, and people said, oh no, the tigers will leave you alone. They will never eat a monk. There's no record of them ever eating a monk. And I said the reason is because a monk can't tell afterwards that he was eaten. He's dead. Elephants kill monks. There's very dangerous, and obviously the snakes as well, heaps of those around. So, you know, they were always, I was always a bit scared of, I actually liked snakes, I wasn't scared of snakes. But, you know, elephants, oh, I know, went to the zoo, elephants were just cute. But tigers, I was always a bit sort of scared of tigers. So I was meditating, there were tigers in the jungle, you see their droppings. And you're meditating there quietly. It's dark, pitch black, you couldn't see anything. It's in the jungle, there's no electric lights anywhere. And if there was stars, there's too much leaves above you to actually have any starlight come through. So sitting there very quietly, and then you started hearing something in the distance, an animal coming towards you. So straight away, you know, you waste the time opening your eyes because you can't see anything, but you'd listen very carefully. Be as mindful as possible of hearing, so you can try and assess whether that's a dangerous animal or not. It was coming towards me, but it's such a small sound. It's probably just a little mouse or just a little jungle, you know, who knows what it was, but it's only a small one, so I just carried on meditating. And as it came closer, you know, my mindfulness was getting stronger, and I realized it wasn't a small animal, it was a medium-sized animal, maybe a civet cat or one of these little jungle deers, but still not really dangerous. So I just closed my eyes and carried on meditating. And then it came even closer, and the closer it got, the more clear I could hear the sound. It wasn't a small animal. That was the sound of a big animal. You can tell by the way it crushed the leaves and broke the twigs. It was making a huge noise. So I realized that this was dangerous. Could it be a tiger or a bear coming right towards me? At that point, I picked up my flashlight, opened my eyes to try and find out what danger I was in. And I saw it. It was, you know, not that far in front of me, a meter or two. A tiny mouse, about this big. And I was just so surprised. I was sure that was a tiger. And I realized that when you have fear, the sound of a mouse becomes indistinguishable from the sound of a tiger. And that really shocked me, but it's a great story to tell, and that's what fear does. It makes a little sort of fever, which you have because, you know, you may have a bit of imbalance in your body, think, this is SARS. You know, this is avian flu. I'm going to die. It's the fear which kills you. The overreaction. So sometimes when you're aware of this emotional world, fear is one of the biggest problems for human beings. So I always call it like a core problem. Anger, guilt, are secondary. Even greed is secondary. Fear is primary. You eat a little bit more for lunch today because you're afraid of being hungry this evening. That's what we do. We get angry at someone because we're afraid they're going to attack us. You know, we have any sort of, most of these reactions are fear-based. That's why I always love to be aware whenever you are afraid and just how that controls you in life. Afraid of what other people say about you. Afraid of being rejected, of not being good enough. Don't worry. If you're a loser in life, ordained as a monk or a nun, because we are losers. I've lost everything. I lost my girlfriend, I lost my money, I lost all my property, I lost my hair. I'm a loser and proud of it. So it's great being a monk, you just, every which way you win. As a monk. So if someone says, Ajahn Brahm, you're a loser. Yes, you understand. And I'm trying to lose a bit more, lose all my defilements, lose everything, lose samsara. So, no, we are the biggest losers because we've given up so much. We've lost so much. So the thing is, you're not afraid of what other people say about you. Imagine going down the streets of the world dressed like this. It's okay in Thailand, they understand who you are. But you go sort of, you know, in London. You know, people in England, they're just so polite. They won't say anything, they just look the other way. Or they cross they cross the other side of the street. Oh, one of my great memories. I was visiting my cousin. He lived in the Midlands in a town called Stoke-on-Trent. I was just visiting him. Sunday morning, you know, I think his wife was making me my lunch. So we'd like to come on a walk, you know, Sunday morning. So we went on a walk through the streets of this town in the middle of England, Stoke-on-Trent. And this time, these English people were looking at me and laughing. They were really laughing. And I thought, wonderful, I'm creating happiness in this world, but I couldn't figure it out. Why was, you know, because most English people look away when they see something weird. Why are they actually looking at me in the face, pointing and laughing so much? And then we came past the street corner, and then there was this big sign, you know, big billboard. Circus was in town. Yes, you got it. They thought I was one of the clowns. That's a true story. You had a wonderful life as a monk or a nun, pretending you're a clown in a circus, visiting Stoke-on-Trent. But whatever. Yeah, don't give a damn what other people think of you. So you got no fear, because you're aware of that. You're aware of what fear is, where it comes from, and what it does to you, and it's just not worth it anymore. And earlier people said about anger. Why on earth are you angry? It is just, I keep on saying, of all of the emotions, it is the most stupid of all. If you get angry at someone, does it ever help? You shout at someone, do they do what you told? No, if it's in Australia, they'll punch you. You know, they'll argue back. And you get divorced, you'll lose friends, and you feel terrible afterwards as well, you know, when you're angry. When you're actually aware of what anger does, it's the most stupid response of all. That is why they have this old saying in Buddhism. This woman went up to the monk, I'm always getting angry, please help me. And the monk took one look at that woman. She was really well dressed, you know, makeup, nice hairdo, everything. She was obviously very concerned about her personal appearance. And that was her weak point. So the monk said, get a mirror. This is how you're going to get rid of your anger. Get a mirror, and the next time you get angry, put it in front of your face, immediately. And she was faithful enough, she followed the instruction. When she was arguing with her husband, got angry, she put the mirror up in front of her face. Oh! She was so embarrassed about what she looked like. She looked like a monster, and it scared her. Now that is a metaphor. If you could only be mindful of what you even look like, or how you feel in your body, the tension, the pain there, or just the crazy mind state you're in. If you were aware of that, you soon get rid of anger. The trouble is, when you're angry, you're not really thinking of yourself. You don't feel yourself, you're not aware of what's going on in your mind. You're aware of that bastard out there who's been late, let you down, cheated you. All your awareness is outside of yourself when you're angry. That's why you never notice what's going on. So if you have trouble with anger, put the mindfulness inside. Get the mirror of mindfulness to feel what you're feeling. It's amazing what you can do then. The other nice thing with mindfulness techniques is there's another way of dealing with those emotions of fear, anxiety, depression, greed or anger. Is once you learn how to be aware, instead of thinking about it, start feeling it in your body and mind, you will notice that every emotion has a corresponding physical feeling to it. Anger, it's got a certain type of feeling in your body. Every time you get angry and upset, if you can only put your awareness inside of you instead of the person who you think is causing the anger, no one causes you to be angry, you choose to be angry. No one can force you to be angry. It's not their fault. It's your stupidity by allowing yourself to get upset by some other stupid person. In Buddhism, everybody is the owner of their karma. If someone else says something stupid to me, sorry, sir, that's your karma. I refuse to get angry. I'm not going to take your stupidity and upset my day because of it. So I refuse to be controlled by other people. You can call me whatever you like. You can call me a fat pig, and all I'd ever say is oink, oink, oink. I'm not going to get upset at you. I'm going to enjoy my day. So you choose to be angry. But when you do get angry, upset, anxious or whatever, you find it has a corresponding physical feeling. So look inside yourself and you find there's a tension, a tightness somewhere. And of course, the classic story, which I've mentioned many times, is a lady over in Adelaide. She has anxiety disorder. She did do. And bedridden. You know, she was a student at Adelaide University studying dentistry. It's a great story. I'm very proud of it because the power of what I did. She was bedridden for days. GP psychologist could not help her. Her piece of good karma, her luck, was her uncle is one of the strong supporters of the monastery. Comes every other week. He was there last Saturday. So her uncle said, give Ajahn Brahm a call. She did. And I asked her, you know, what's up? And she says, I'm anxious, I'm just paranoid and depressed, in bed, can't get out of bed. And I've been stuck like this for weeks. And I feel disgusting, terrible. But I'm too afraid to go outside the bedroom door. And I told her, I said, well, you know, when you get anxious like that, where do you feel it in your body? I don't know. I said, that's your test. Find out for me. I'm going to give you a call in a week or two's time, and I want you to tell me, it's not a week's time, I think about 3 days' time, I want you to tell me where you feel it in your body when you have an anxiety attack. So you call 3 days later, he said, I feel it in my chest, just below my breast, just in this chest area here. I said, great, what does it feel like? Describe it to me. I don't know. Give me a call in 3 days and tell me what it's like. And number one, it gave her something to do, so she wasn't just relying on other people, which was an important thing, to give people power, self-empowerment over their treatment. And that's what mindfulness does. It's not telling you what to do, it's telling you how to do it. And then she was gave me a call. And she's obviously a very smart girl studying at university. She gave me this very beautiful, detailed description of the feeling she has in her chest when she has an anxiety attack. I said, brilliant. Now, I said, now you're mindful of it, you're aware of what it feels like. Now, next time you have an anxiety attack, take your hand and massage that feeling. Massage the area of your body. And I told her, if you can't do it, she had a boyfriend who was looking after her. So get your boyfriend to do that for you. That's what boyfriends are there for. Massage you. And okay, she said she'd do that and give me a call in 3 days. And I asked her after 3 days, you know, she was in Adelaide, I was in Perth, and said, what happened when you massaged that? First of all, did you do that? He said, yeah, I did that. what happened when you massaged that feeling when you had an anxiety attack? And she said, oh, you know, just I massaged it and the pain in my chest disappeared. They said, what happened to your anxiety? And that's when I always remember she paused. There was silence for about 20 seconds. And then she said, the anxiety went away too. Great, now you have your method. And it was only a couple of weeks later, she was out of bed. And she went back to university. This is no exaggeration, she got first class honours in dentistry. And then she went on to this course in Sydney, this post-grad course. I think 100 people applied, they were only taking 3. She got one of those 3 places. Brilliant girl. And that boy who massaged her chest, she married him. And I did the marriage service for them. That was so cute. Anyway, it literally saved her life. And it's just mindfulness, understanding that, you know, instead of thinking about it and worrying about it, you know, it's hard for many people to understand their emotional world, but it always has a physical counterpart. So if ever you're angry, anxious, upset, feel it in your body, because it's much easier to massage it in your body. But later on, when you get really aware of your mental world, you can almost massage it in your mind as well. So, you know, I get in a bad mood. I'm a monk, I'm a teacher, I'm not supposed to be in a bad mood. So what do? It's all right, I jump on to be in a bad mood. Never mind, it's okay. And this is actually what I do, I get my hand up and go, it's okay, jump on. You may be a stupid monk, but at least I love me. Now you may laugh, it actually works. You know, it's the compassion, the kindness, the awareness together with the kindness that really works. Which is why, what do we call it these days? My favorite word which I invented? Kindfulness. So this is not just mindfulness meditations. Because I've seen people doing mindfulness technique meditations and they're just such pain in the asses to live with. Stop! Banging the door, you're spoiling my mindfulness. Now, I think you're laughing because you've seen that before. Isn't there something wrong there somewhere? Yeah, okay, they're being mindful, they're trying to be aware. There's no kindness, no softness, no compassion there. They're just being aware for no purpose. So, you are kindful. And you find when you're aware and you're kind, not just your body relaxes and all the aches and pains vanishes and you can eat without getting indigestion. Not only that, but you can actually understand your emotional world. And you're dealing with, what is massage? Only just this beautiful act of kindness. Caressing your own body, relaxing, it's okay. What is me? It's just stroking my hair. It's just being kind to myself. Awareness and kindness go together. That's an essential feature of meditation. And you start it with maybe just healing your body, making sure that breast cancers don't come. If they do, they can sap them away with mindfulness and kindness. Making sure that any emotions which come up, you understand them, you learn from them, and you're just so kind to them. They vanish. The monster in the Emperor's Palace, welcome. You relax so much, and you feel the awareness gives you the feedback. All those problems of anger, fear, just have gone. You have a wonderful life when you feel those emotions, and then you sit on your chair or your cushion. You're just not afraid of meditation. You're just enjoying whatever happens in meditation. Now you wander off. Oh, be kind to it. You're aware and you're kind. You find that then the mind doesn't want to wander off anymore. Am I a kind monk or a very cruel monk? I think I'm a kind monk. One of the reasons is it's so hard to get on these retreats. You'd think, you know, that be sort of, you know, you have to force people to go on a retreat. If there was a cruel monk, of course you wouldn't want to go on this retreat. And even if I paid you, you wouldn't come. But people would like to have kindness, compassion. You know, it brings, compassion is what causes the one-pointedness, it brings things together. So if you want to have a still mind, you've got to be kind to it. Don't be so cruel to it. Stop beating up your mind. Stupid mind. I've been meditating for years here and I still can't even get to even watching the breath for 3 seconds. Stupid, stupid, stupid. You do things like that and you really are stupid. Instead, it's, oh, it's okay. The very fact you're coming here, that's wonderful. You know, when you get it sometime or other, you know, if not this retreat, well, another retreat, who cares anyway? I'm going to be kind to myself. There must be some cause. It's none of my business anyway. It just happens. As long as I'm on Buddha air, it gets to the destination sooner or later. With those sorts of kind words, you relax. You're not afraid. You're not angry at yourself, which means you get so peaceful. Actually, you begin to like yourself, which means you can hang out with you. You can spend hours just sitting here. I'm just hanging out with my best friend Ajahn Brahm, sitting here, hanging out together for hours. You don't wander off. You're not going anywhere because you're with your best friend. You're with your mind, with your breath, having a great time because you're aware and you're kind. No fear, no control, just being. Now you know what mindfulness is. And little by little, it grows and grows. It's not just ordinary mind, it really starts to take off after a while. And you can really see your body, every part of it. You can really see your mind. You can really see life. Superpower mindfulness. And again, the amazing thing is, when you get to that superpower mindfulness, everything is just so beautiful. Oh yes, give me more. Oh yeah. Whoa. Whoa. Whoa, yeah. So that's what it's like. Okay. Sadhu. Sadhu. Yes. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that talk. And 11 o'clock when you have your lunch, remember...